everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sale, and today, following on from last week's show, we're bringing you a trio of exclusive interviews with the authors in contention for the Costa Book of the Year Award. John McGregor discusses the sense of loss that haunts his novel Reservoir 13.
It's a novel about what happens to a community when a tragedy kind of lands in its midst.
Rebecca Stott relives her childhood in a religious cult in her memoir In the Days of Rain.
So we knew nothing else. And yes, people use the word repressive. And one of the amazing things about having letters from people who've read the book is how shocked people are.
Children's author Catherine Rundle tells us why she thinks that every child should be an explorer.
They are brilliant readers. They read with their whole heart and they remember what they read and they get obsessed by what they read.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. John McGregor is one of the most acclaimed writers of novels and short stories in the UK. All four of his novels to date have been in contention for major literary prizes. Most recently, Reservoir 13, which won the 2017 Costa Novel of the Year Award. It tells the story of many lives haunted by the tragedy of one family's loss. After a teenage girl on holiday with her parents goes missing from a village in the heart of rural England. The Costa judges described the novel as hypnotic, compelling and original. It certainly had me charmed and gripped from page one.
They gathered at the car park in the hour before dawn and waited to be told what to do. It was cold and there was little conversation. There were questions that weren't being asked. The missing girl's name was Rebecca Shaw. When last seen, she'd been wearing a white hooded top. A mist hung low across the moor and the ground was frozen hard. They were given instructions and then they moved off, their boots crunching on the stiffened ground and their tracks fading behind them as the heather sprang back into shape. She was 5 feet tall with dark blonde hair. She had been missing for hours. They kept their eyes down and they didn't speak and they wondered what they might find. The only sounds were footsteps and dogs barking along the road and faintly a helicopter from the reservoirs. The helicopter had been out all night and found nothing, its searchlights skimming across the heather and surging brown streams. Jackson's sheep had taken the fear and had scattered through a broken gate, and he had been up all hours bringing them back. The mountain rescue teams and the cave teams and the police had found nothing, and at midnight a search had been called. It hadn't taken much to raise the volunteers. Half the village was out already, talking about what could have happened. This was no time of year to have gone up on the hill, it was said. Some of the people who come this way don't know how sharply the weather can turn, how quickly darkness falls. Some of them don't seem to know there are places a mobile phone won't work.
Matt Bates narrating Reservoir 13, written by my guest, John McGregor. John McGregor, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Reservoir 13 starts very much like a conventional crime novel and has the girl's disappearance at the centre of it, but actually it morphs into something very different. How would you describe the novel?
It's a novel about what happens to a community when a tragedy kind of lands in its midst. So it starts off being about the disappearance of the girl, but it actually becomes about how people carry on with their lives after something like that has happened, and the something is never made clear. And it's really for me, it became a book about the passing of time and what the passing of time does to people, to communities, to how we process significant events in our life.
There's a very telling line early on in the book. People just wanted to know, they felt involved, which is very much the feeling of the community wanting to know what the mystery is, but it's also how we feel as readers, you draw us into the community, don't you?
Yeah, that's what happens in the books I enjoy reading. And I think so. It's kind of what I like to try and do when I'm writing is to try and make the reader feel involved and maybe also feel complicit in a way, engaged. I mean, one of the questions I was dealing with was because the girl who goes missing and her family, they're not from the village, they're not part of the community. People who are left behind, they're upset by what's happened. They're kind of traumatized to some extent, but at the same time, they don't know her personally. And so there's no personal grief or loss. And so some of what they're feeling is in a way kind of voyeuristic or at least secondhand. And that mirrors the experience the reader has. And I kind of wanted to provoke the reader into thinking about that and wondering about that. And what does that secondhandness mean? What does that voyeurism mean? And in terms not just of this novel, but of all novels where you're kind of exploring somebody else's tragedy.
Yes, and the constant annual return by the press to the disappearance and the way the missing girl's name changes from Rebecca to Bex to Becky indicates to the reader that actually a private tragedy has become public property.
Yeah, and that's what always happens in these kind of news stories. The person at the centre of it very quickly becomes quite two-dimensional. There's usually only one photograph of them that is used over and over again. The name that the press used might not actually be the name that the family used for that, I mean, particularly when it's a child. And so you get a very kind of flat two-dimensional image of who this person is and what this loss means to the family. And I quite deliberately left Becky very two-dimensional in the novel because of that.
Now, you do drop hints and maybe clues into the plot. I think the very title Reservoir 13 and the recurrence of the number 13 throughout the book are there to tantalise the reader. Were you tempted at all to go further into the mystery to solve it?
No, I wasn't. And I think people have seen more clues in the book than I put there deliberately. I decided very early on I knew from the outset that this was going to be a book where the mystery wasn't solved. The girl disappears and that's the tragedy, that she's disappeared and that the family don't have any answers and that's their sadness. And I knew from the beginning that's what the book would be about. And I decided quite early on that in order to kind of stay true to that, I had to make sure that I never decided for myself what it is that's happened to Becky. And so every time I kind of found myself speculating about what the outcome might have been, I kind of quite deliberately pulled back and left that as speculation. And throughout the book, there are, you know, people discuss possibilities. You know, I mean, I think the first thing that people assume is that something horrible has happened to her. Some person has done something horrible to her. And that is a reasonable assumption, given the kind of history of these cases. But equally, she could have fallen in a hole. She could have run away. She could have, there are all sorts of things that could have happened. And those are kind of speculated about over the course of the book. But no, I carefully held back from deciding that for myself because I didn't want it to be something that I knew that I was kind of taunting the reader with. I wanted it to be genuinely a known unknown. And the really interesting thing is that, yeah, people have seen more clues than I thought were there. The title of the book isn't supposed to be significant in terms of what's happened to her. But I think people are trained, certainly in fiction and drama, people are trained to expect clues and to expect solutions and to expect to be able to kind of put these things together like a crossword puzzle. But in real life, that is often not the case.
Yes, I suppose it's the reader's expectations rather than you tantalising the reader's expectations. And certainly, actually, the cycle of the seasons, which you chart beautifully in the background, shows that it's a human preoccupation to know what's going on, whereas the animals, the weather, even the minerals just get on with it themselves.
Yeah. And I think that was, I don't know if that was deliberate from the outset, but that kind of became quite a central idea for me, that all of this other life is simply continuing in a kind of unthinking way. You know, all the kind of animal cycles of life and the plants and even to an extent people's working routines, you know, a lot of the jobs that people have in the book are the sorts of jobs where you just have to do the same things every day. Like if you're a dairy farmer, you have to bring the cows back inside and milk them in the evening, no matter what's happened that day. You know, and you have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and milk them again, no matter what a terrible night you had. You know, does people's working lives are almost a kind of extension of the natural rhythms of the world that this community lives in. And there was a sense I was kind of groping towards of trying to use that to contextualize the tragedy that's kind of landed in their laps and the way that they process that within the passing of time.
It's a beautiful evocation of nature and of the Peak District. You're not a local. Did you have to embed yourself in the Peak District to learn the local names for various animals, insects and plants? Or
I mean, not yes and no. I live in Nottingham, so the Peak District is on my doorstep, as it's on so many people's doorsteps. And if I go walking and cycling, camping, that's where I go. So I know it as a visitor, and I know it reasonably well as a visitor. But I was very conscious when I decided to set the book there that I don't know it as a resident. I don't know it as somebody who works in that landscape. And so I did have to do a lot of research. And I think my first instinct was to try and kind of, yeah, as you say, embed myself and kind of try and arrange, like, I don't know, a month, almost like internships, like a month working with a gamekeeper and a month working with a sheep farmer. And that never really came off. So in the end, I did most of my research through books and online. And at the beginning, I thought, well, that's going to be far too superficial. That's not going to do the job. But actually, it's really interesting. I mean, it sounds glib, but there are a lot of farmers on social media. And actually, by following a whole stack of farmers and gamekeepers and river keepers and whoever else on Twitter, I got a really nice, quite rich account of people's daily lives and people's vocabulary and people's kind of day-to-day concerns. And that actually built up very quickly into a really kind of valuable body of research. And then what I did was I showed key people the finished manuscript, and they were able to kind of pick out all the stuff that sounded stupid and wrong.
A pale light moved slowly across the moor, catching in the flooded cloughs and ditches and sharpening until the clouds closed overhead. On the riverbank towards the weir at dusk, a heron stood and watched the water. A slow fog came down from the hills overnight. At 4 in the morning, Les Thompson was up and bringing the cows across the yard for milking. Later in the day, the vicar was seen driving to the Hunter place.
It's a very compelling audiobook read by Matt Bates. Did you have any choice as to who your narrator was, and have you listened to it yourself?
I did, actually, yeah. I was certainly consulted. And, yeah, I was quite keen. I think the temptation with a book like this would be for somebody in London to cast somebody with a very, very definitely kind of northern accent and to kind of really go to town on it being a country accent. And actually, for me, it was important that that wasn't the case, that, you know, Derbyshire is a big county, Peak District is a big area with a huge range of people from all sorts of different backgrounds and different contexts and different accents and different voices. And I wanted the voice to be quite low key and not kind of take prominence. And I think he reads it really nicely. I mean, I haven't listened to the whole thing. That would be kind of excruciating for me, I think, the same way I haven't read the whole book since it's published. But yeah, I think he's done a great job. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that you've enjoyed reading the book in that way.
I think it reflects your prose style, which is not flowery at all. It's, I don't want to say matter of fact, because that isn't the right word, but it presents the facts in a clear and undramatic way, and the drama is actually in the questions that surround the disappearance and people's reaction to it, rather than in flashy language.
Yeah, I mean, I think matter of fact is a good description, to be honest. I think that was one of the things I was aiming for, and I was really, I think particularly with any kind of nature writing, any kind of writing about the natural world, there's a real temptation to flower up the language and to kind of really go to town on describing the way things look and the way things are. And what I was finding in the course of my research, actually, the natural world is full of poetry in the sense of just the way things are, you know, and you don't need to kind of flower it up. And I was quite keen to just give, make it matter of fact, kind of present people with the facts of, this is when the blackbirds lay their eggs. This is what they use to make their nests. This is what a fledgling blackbird looks like when it first tries to fly. You know, all of those kind of little, just one sentence details that would build up to create a bigger picture. So yeah, matter of fact was kind of what I was aiming for.
On your website, you say that your Britain's second best story writer, which I think is a reference to coming second in the BBC short story competition a couple of times.
Yeah.
Now that you've won the Costa Novel of the Year Award for 2017, have you laid that to rest, and are you hopeful to win the Costa Award of 2017 overall?
I think I laid that to rest a long time ago. I think prizes are fun when you're part of them. They're more fun when you win them, and they shouldn't be taken too seriously. It's sometimes hard to not take them too seriously. They do a great job of bringing books to the attention of readers. Sometimes they do a great job of bringing books to the attention of readers that otherwise would have been overlooked and are worth, you know, putting in front of readers. Sometimes they get their choices wrong, and the question of what wrong means is completely subjective. Sometimes when you're sort of involved on the fringes of it and you don't get as far as you were hoping to get, it all feels a bit like a kind of beauty pageant. But on the whole, I'd say that if you don't take them too seriously and you enjoy them for what they are, then prizes can be a lot of fun. And it's certainly been hugely pleasing to have won the Novel of the Year Award. Obviously, that's a lovely affirmation. And I'm trying very hard not to give any thought at all to who might win the Book of the Year Award.
Well, I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for appearing as a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Reservoir 13, narrated by Matt Bates, is TB701860 and is also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB library.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books. Still to come in this week's show, children's author Catherine Rundle has a gift for describing the exhilaration of being in peril. But before that, this year's Costa Award for Biography was won by Rebecca Stott for In the Days of Rain. It's a frank and moving childhood memoir of life in the Exclusive Brethren, a secretive hardline sect of Christian fundamentalists. Stott's father was an influential and charismatic priest within the sect who eventually led his family out. It was his dying wish that she should write this memoir, which charts both her family's long association with the Exclusive Brethren and the aftermath of that decision to leave. Rebecca, welcome to Read On.
Hello.
The world you describe is quite a repressive and separatist one. You grew up with no newspapers, TV, radio, holidays or cinema.
Yeah, absolutely. They wouldn't have thought of themselves as such. They would have described themselves as being separatist in order to keep themselves and their community, which was mainly made up of large families, sort of clean from the contaminations of the world. That's the way they saw it. And I say they, you know, these were, as my children say, these were my people. The group was set up in the early 19th century as one of those many sort of dissenting, extremely Puritan groups that wanted to live according to the principles of the early Christian church and worked very hard to do so. But eventually they became more and more and more separatist, more and more obsessed with separating from the world. So by the time I was born in the 60s, the group had become very different from its earlier incarnation, insofar as it was still operating the same principles, but in a very sort of paranoid, extreme way. So it had sort of upped all the rules enormously. So by the time I was born, yeah, no contact really with anybody from the outside world. We were living in the suburbs of Brighton, and I was born fourth generation into this group. So, of course, I knew nothing else. People, this group does, the Exclusive Brethren don't recruit. They really just carry on having very large families. And if that means that everyone in the group has been born into it, then you've really got a very compliant group who really don't know any other way of living in the world. So we had, yeah, no, none of those things, no television, no radio, no pets, no newspapers. We went to an ordinary school, but we weren't really allowed to talk to the other children. And even if we did, we had nothing in common with them anyway. And we looked weird. We were dressed in very sort of old-fashioned ways and stood out from the rest of the class. So I had lots of my lessons separately from the rest of the children in my school. And that meant sitting in a long corridor in the school, getting on with worksheets and things like that. So we knew nothing else. And yes, people use the word repressive. And one of the amazing things about having letters from people who've read the book is how shocked people are by what I describe. And I know it's shocking. You know, of course I do. I've lived in the normal world for a very long time. We left when I was 7. But certainly the shock that people describe, that this group still continues, and it does. It's got 45,000 people, members in the world, and 16,000 in the UK alone. You know, the word repressive, I guess we didn't feel it because we knew nothing else. It just was a world in which every part of our day, every part of our lives was circumscribed by the group, by going to meeting. We had to go to meeting 4 times on a Sunday, once every evening. And, you know, there were endless Bible readings and things like that. But if you grow up in that, then that's all you know.
Was it upsetting revisiting your childhood through the book?
That's such an interesting question. It wasn't an upsetting childhood in any sort of obvious way. I mean, yes, of course it was. It was a baffling one, a confusing one, and a very surreal one, not just because we lived in a weird world, but because when we came out of it, the world outside seemed even weirder. So for me, I've been carrying these stories and these memories around with me all of my life. I'm 53 now, and I just wanted to see if I could put all the fragments down, put all the jigsaw pieces into one big picture so that I could see it more clearly, you know, just and try to understand, well, what did that feel like? And what was it like for my father, not just for me, because this isn't just a book about me, it's about my father, who was also born into the cult, was a very strange and complicated and rather brilliant man. And so was it upsetting? No. I mean, interestingly, I wrote most of it at night, and I don't normally do that. It felt often as though it was safer to write at night and that I could get closer to the feelings when I was writing at night. But it was just sort of fascinating to sort of say, ah, so that bit goes there. And also to fill in the gaps. So there were a lot of things I didn't know about the group. So I had to reach out to people who'd left at the same time as us, people who grew up alongside my father, friends of my parents, and just say to them, well, look, what actually did happen right then? And what did it feel like? And none of them wanted me to name them. So they all had to be anonymous in the book. But the emails that were coming back from them, you know, that was the really shocking bit, because there were so many gaps that I had as a child. I didn't understand how this had happened or that had happened, or because there were lots of secrets. But gradually the picture started to emerge. It was like being a detective. So no, it was sort of sometimes upsetting and sometimes embarrassing. You know, I'd write something down and I'd think, what are people going to make of that? That's just so weird. And then other times just completely fascinating, as though I was, you know, I was at the center of my own detective drama. And, you know, my eyes were getting wider and wider, and I'd just become more and more astonished, because it was what I found when I started doing the investigating was much worse than I had expected.
You mention your father, and he looms very large throughout the book. A very charismatic man, and also a priest in the order who was responsible for, well, the Inquisition that the Brethren went through during the 1960s.
Yeah. Inquisition's a good word. It's not a word I use in the book, but yeah, absolutely, Inquisition. And it's what happens with a lot of cults when they become very isolated from the world, that, you know, the story just, you know, if you look at, well, I say cults or totalitarian systems, and this was a totalitarian system in the suburbs of Britain, you know, in all these secret places. Often what happens, if you think about Stalinism or Maoism or, you know, some of these big, very extreme totalitarian groups, is they become more and more obsessed with control. And so forced confession becomes one of the ways in which you can control, because then everybody's living in a state of fear. So the people who are doing the forced confessions, in my case, they were called priestly visits, which is even more sinister in a way. A pair of ministering brothers or priests would come to your house and put you under investigation for, well, put you under interrogation for several hours at a time. And if you didn't come up with the goods, or if you weren't compliant, or if you didn't come right with the Lord, as they would put it, then you'd be shut up. And shutting up, well, the language of all of this is so fascinating. Shutting up meant effectively being isolated in your own house from the rest of your family, not able to talk to them or come to meeting. Often people would be shut up for weeks, months at a time. And of course, you know, in the 60s, when things were really, really extreme, there were suicides, there were mental breakdowns. It was all covered up. It was all kept very, very quiet. But my father, yes, was a, they used words like compliance officer and exactor and words like that, you know, just he, like many young men, were expected to do some of the forced confessions, the interrogations. And when he died 10 years ago, he was absolutely haunted by memories of those experiences, of his own power, of his own compliance, of his own cruelty. And he'd call himself a young Nazi. You know, I was a young Nazi. That was the Nazi decade, he'd say. He was just tormented and tortured by those memories and trying to write them down. And he failed to do so because it was just so painful. So the book began really as a promise to him that I would try to figure out some of the questions that he was tormented by. You know, why did we do it? Why didn't we get out? Why did we agree to behaving in that way? So, yeah, in some ways, that was some of the most painful work of the book, that I had to really try to be inside my father's head for those sections of the book and really try and see the world through his eyes. And he did not behave well as a father or as a priest, but he was one of my most cherished human beings on the planet. He was an extraordinary man, infuriating, irresponsible, larger than life, but also one of the most special people I've ever known. So that was a real challenge too. I wanted to get a portrait of him and of his life and try to figure out how much, you know, that terrible experience and his own repressed life had led to, you know, the obsessive gambling that took hold of him when we left the Brethren, the fact that he went to prison, you know, and then bounced back and came out of prison and became a BBC producer and then lost his job and so on. You know, he was such an erratic man, but also such a colourful and interesting one.
I found that the most moving part of the book, the lack of self-belief, because you can't have self-belief if you are told to believe absolutely in an all-powerful God. You will always be questioning whether you're going to live up to that absolute being. And yet you have managed to harness it and fly. It's informed your success.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. Yeah, I think so. It's not to say that I'm not marked by it. I think I'm extremely and deeply marked by it. And I think I realized that as I was writing it. But I think being marked by something and being victimized or being being damaged by something is different. And I think as a writer, you have to know what it is that you're interested in and what drives you and what you're obsessed by. And you work that, you know, you have your own demons, yes, but you have your own fascinations and obsessions as well. And I have a lot of obsessions. And I guess over the years, I've realized how many of them were fledged. Those obsessions were fledged in those early years in the Brethren when I was a curious child. You know, I was compliant. I did try to be good. I did want to go in the rapture. I did want to behave. I wanted to be a good girl. But at the same time, I was also wildly curious, both about sort of theological things, but about the secrets in the family, about the rules that were being broken, about the contradictions I could see around me constantly. And I guess in some ways that turned me into a bit of an amateur detective, even as a child, you know, that it turned me into a free thinker, weirdly. You know, cults don't usually produce free thinkers. But I was lucky. We left when I was 7, you know, and what would have happened if, you know, and although we left when I was 7, the aftershocks of that experience reverberated in our family and still do. You know, I mean, the number of people who won't talk about it, the number of people who are still really, really scarred by it in my wider family. And of course, the number of family members who stayed in and who've never had any contact with us since. But I would say that what I've tried to do, and I'm not always successful with it, is to sort of take my life as it is, you know, not see myself as a victim or but as someone who has been shaped, and we're all shaped by our experiences, and to try to continue to attend to the questions that really matter to me. And a lot of them are around women and about control and about power and about how systems of power work and how they grow and how they evolve and why people want to be led. But also I'm really interested in the power of the imagination, that even in a very, very controlling group, there's a bit of the human unconscious and the human mind that no controlling group can ever reach, you know, that you can use your imagination and the sort of poetry inside your head to, even without books, and we had no books, you know, we had a few books, you know, that the world of the imagination is such a powerful place. That's where we fly.
And that love of books is something that you inherited clearly from your father and has fed into your wonderful historical thrillers like Ghost Walk and The Coral Thief. But also you've written a couple of books about Darwin as well. And I wondered if, especially Darwin's Ghosts, which is available as a talking book from the RNIB library, which charts 2,200 years of free thinkers questioning the orthodox belief in the creation story. Do you think that that questioning came directly from your experience within the Exclusive Brethren?
It must have done. I mean, you're not many people who write two books on Darwin or Darwinian thought. That's a kind of a bit of an obsession, I think, and has been for years. Probably 10 years I spent thinking about Darwin and about Darwinian ideas. But yes, in my childhood, we had an encyclopedia, which we were allowed to consult. But that encyclopedia had, when I went to look up Darwin, because we were told that Darwin was one of the many mouthpieces of Satan. You know, Satan was in the world. Satan had all of these mouthpieces. Satan owned the world, and everyone outside our group belonged to Satan. But that there are particularly wicked people who've been sent to Earth to lead people away from the right path and the light. And Charles Darwin was one of those. So I grew up hearing him talked about as the monkey man. And I think as a child, that kind of characterization was particularly fascinating. So I went to look him up in the encyclopedia, only to find that the page where Darwin should have been had been razored out by my grandfather when the encyclopedias arrived in the 50s. So years later, when I, you know, well, some years later, I found the pages on Darwin and evolution in the school encyclopedia. And then for years, it was just a complete fascination as a way of seeing. You know, we grew up with this really Manichaean way of seeing. You know, X means Y. Everything is either black or white, good or bad. And And to have somebody or to read about somebody who proposed a much more kind of watery and fluid and metamorphosing and strange and beautiful way of the history of the world, you know, that for me was, you know, it wasn't that, oh, Darwin's right and the Bible's wrong and or anything like that. It was just like, oh, there's different ways of thinking about these things. There's different ways of talking about how the human race has evolved. And so that became a kind of, I think in the book I describe it as like a poetry. You know, there was something about the Darwinian way of seeing. There was a kind of poetry that I kept coming back to year after year.
Now, you narrate In the Days of Rain yourself, which is always a treat for those of us who rely on audiobooks. Did you feel it was important to tell your own story?
It wasn't quite like that. It was, well, my publishers asked me whether I wanted to do it. And I hesitated, I have to say, because I just thought, oh, I'm not sure I can do that. I'm not sure I want to read the book again, let alone read it out loud. So I really wasn't sure. But I also couldn't countenance anybody else doing it either. I kept thinking, well, there are loads of great actors out there and that could do a good job with this. And maybe they'd do a better job than me. But I just thought, no, you know, they wouldn't know. And, you know, they wouldn't know how to do that bit or that bit. So it wasn't that I thought I was better, it's just that it was difficult to hand it over to anybody else. So it was an amazing experience. I've never done it before. A tiny little studio recording room with a little glass panel in the wall where I could see the producer on the other side with headphones and he would talk to me. So it was a bit like being underwater or something like that. You know, it's a really small room. I'd be in it for 5 or 6 hours, you come out into the sort of coffee area, exhausted, voice probably needing to rest a bit. And there'd be other people out there, other actors, other authors, who'd just come out of their own little pods. And so we'd have a conversation and someone would say, oh, I'm doing a children's book, or I'm doing a novel that's full of the most gruesome bloody scenes. So it was quite surreal because there I was talking about my life story in this little pod. Felt very safe, very secure. The producer was amazing and very supportive, and every now and again he'd say, right, you need a break now, or he'd make me read something again. But we charged through it. He'd allowed 4 days for it, and we did it in 3. And I think that's because once I started and built up a head of steam, it wasn't that I wanted to get through it. It's just I didn't want to stop. It's like, okay, let's just keep going. But yeah, it was an amazing experience. Not in some ways, very intense. And I think it must be for anyone who's telling their own story into a microphone in a tiny room for 3 days. Kind of an inoculation, I think, because when I'd finished it, I was exhausted, but also kind of, I did it, you know. I spoke every word out loud.
After the funeral and the wake and the speeches and the fire we burned his chair in, my brother and I ventured into my father's study, stacked high with papers. It all had to be cleared out, my stepmother said, if the mill was to be sold. We rescued anything that looked important from piles of unpaid bills, receipts, photographs, and instructions for long-dead appliances. If I was going to finish his book, I told my brother, I was going to need everything that looked as if it had anything to do with the brethren. So we shoved stacks of letters and diaries and yellowed documents into boxes without sorting through them. My brother and my son helped me carry the 6 boxes up 3 flights of stairs in my Cambridge house and slip them into the dark and dusty space under my Victorian iron bed. I'd deal with them later, I told myself, when I was ready, when I had time.
In the Days of Rain, written and narrated by Rebecca Stott, is TB701933. Children's author Catherine Rundle has a gift for describing the exhilaration of being in peril. Her 2013 novel Rooftoppers follows the escapades of a pair of charming crooks who inhabit the rooftops of 19th century Paris and London. Her latest book, The Explorer, has just won the Costa Children's Book of the Year. It begins with a plane crash that plunges four children and the reader into the savage beauty of the Amazon rainforest and a battle for survival.
Fred wondered as he ran if he was dead, but he thought death would surely be quieter. The roar of the flames and his own blood vibrated through his hands and feet. The night was black. He tried to heave in breath to shout for help as he ran, but his throat was too dry and ashy to yell. He jabbed his finger into the back of his tongue to summon up spit. "Is anybody there? Help! Fire!" he shouted. The fire called back in response. A tree behind him sent up a fountain of flames. There was a rumble of thunder. Nothing else replied. A burning branch cracked, spat red, and fell in a cascade of sparks. Fred leapt away, stumbling backwards into the dark and smacking his head against something hard. The branch landed exactly where he'd been standing seconds before.
Peter Noble narrating The Explorer, whose author Catherine Rundle joins me via Skype from Zimbabwe. Catherine Rundle, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
So congratulations on winning the Costa Children's Book of the Year 2017. Has it sunk in yet?
It has, only because I was told about a month before everyone else was told. So it took me about a month and a week to get there, but I think it has finally seemed like it's real.
And it's a really gripping adventure story. And I hear it was inspired very much by your own adventures in the Amazon rainforest.
That's right, with my then boyfriend, now very good friend. And you fly to Manaus, which is the city on the edge of the water. And then we took a large boat, a passenger boat, and then a much smaller boat, and then a tiny boat. And the tiny boat took us down the tributaries of the Amazon. And it's just an extraordinary place. The feel of it, the smells, the textures, the sight, it's just extraordinary to see. I mean, the things to swim in that water, which is body temperature and which rushes past you, and it's full of piranhas and caiman. It feels like an adventure.
I was going to ask, did you have any close encounters with the rather threatening animals out there?
We had several close encounters. We had many swimming events when we'd suddenly see that there would be caiman on the other side of the bay, which we were told was actually very safe. But there was one moment when we were catching piranha for our dinner, and we put them all in the bottom of the boat, and our guy, a man called Tarek, bent down to pick up. It wasn't actually dead, and it bit the tip off his finger.
Oh, oh my goodness. And then presumably you had to gut them before eating them as well?
Yes, so we you flake off the scales and then you gut them and then you roast them, and they are just really very delicious. They're a great, great fish to eat.
Did you eat anything else strange out there as well? Because the heroes of your book certainly seem to tuck into the wildlife.
So almost everything in the book we actually ate, because I wanted to make sure that it felt real. So they eat these grubs that live inside cocoa pods. They find various sources of water. They cut open lianas, which taste of a certain kind of juice, and that's all real. The only thing that isn't real is they eat tarantulas. And although we caught tarantulas, we were not allowed to eat them.
Because they're a protected species, or?
No, not because they're protected at all. In fact, lots of people do eat them. I think it's just it wasn't dinner time. And, you know, we didn't have a fire and it was not convenient.
And there's a strong environmental message that comes through the pages of the book.
Exactly. So I guess the thing that I realise that I've always known, because I grew up in Zimbabwe, and the only thing that puts it in threat is us, is mankind. And we would go past in our boat swathes of forest which had been hacked down for ranches or for logging, and they would look like the land had been attacked and, you know, the rainforest is disappearing every year, and kids are the ones who will have to save it.
Your books are aimed at a preteen audience, so you clearly feel that at that age they're able to take these fairly weighty issues on board.
I think so, and I think it's also that readers of the age I write for, which is, I guess, about 8 to 13, they are brilliant readers. They read with their whole heart and they remember what they read and they get obsessed by what they read. And what they read at that age really, I think, gets under their skin, or at least certainly it did for me and for my friends. And I think I wanted to write for that age range because I felt that that is an age range where you can offer someone something new. You can offer them a new slice of the world.
You've attracted a bit of criticism from perhaps overprotective parents who worry that some of the things you write about might be a bit scary for children or dangerous if kids try to copy them. I'm thinking especially of roof climbing. But it sounds like you believe that children of that age are able to make sensible decisions and take on challenges. They certainly are in The Explorer.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, this idea that adults are sort of somewhat perturbed by my books, I think, has been slightly over-exaggerated by the news. One person once was worried about their child because their child went climbing up onto a roof once they'd read Roof Toppers. And another kid broke an ankle climbing a tree, which I refuse to take complete responsibility for. But by and large, I think children are adventurers. And, you know, I certainly broke a lot of bones growing up. But in exchange, I got to experience the world, you know, with my hands and feet. I got to really feel the way the world operates. I got to climb and run. Children are natural explorers, and we shouldn't hold them back if, you know, they must explore to the best of their capability, whatever that might be.
I was struck by a line towards the end of The Explorer: "You're right to be afraid, but be brave anyway." I think that's a fantastic piece of advice for children to receive.
Absolutely. I think it makes perfect sense. You'd be mad not to be afraid at least half the things out there. But the thing about fear is it's not necessarily rational. And that if you can just get past the fear, there is so much waiting for you on the other side. And I think kids, of course, they're afraid. The world is so fresh to them. But if we can tell them not to be afraid, or at least not to be afraid, but not to be stopped by their fear, I think that is a thing worth knowing.
And the children in The Explorer learn by their observation of the, well, alien environment around them, and that's why they survive. Is that a message maybe also to our rather cosseted generation of children?
I don't know. I'm not sure that this generation is that closeted. I think they are less lucky than some in that they have fewer spaces where they're allowed to play. But of course, that's not their fault. I think I just wanted to say, run and climb and explore and seek out the world while you're still young.
You've mentioned climbing a couple of times, and I know we share a favourite book in common, The Night Climbers of Cambridge, which was written by and about a group of students who explored the roofs of the university colleges in the 1930s. As a student and now a don at Oxford University, how did you come across the book?
A friend told me about it. My father had often spoken about it when I was a child as well, and I had always been a climber. And it's a brilliant book. I mean, they really did push it to the point of it being borderline insane.
And have you done much night climbing at Oxford?
I did a little bit. I'm a fellow of All Souls College in Oxford, and that has a rooftop that you can access via a trapdoor above a lavatory, above a library. And I've been up there with several other fellow friends.
That exhilaration you get from finding a new perspective on things comes through in all your books, especially Roof Toppers.
Yeah, I think that's maybe one thing that the books all have in common, which is that I grew up living in different countries, and you see that there isn't really one right way of doing it. And that's very liberating. It means it gives you freedom to look at the world as you choose. And, you know, whether that's physically from up above the rooftops of Paris or emotionally, I think it's something that's worth leaning on as you grow up. I think it allows you to be honest and true to yourself.
All four of your books are available from the RNIB library in a range of accessible formats, including as audiobooks. You must be delighted to reach an audience who might not otherwise be able to read them.
I am. I'm thrilled. the more readers of any kind that you can get your book into their hands, that's the thing that every author longs for. And I love the audiobooks. They are a real delight to listen to, although it is one of those very peculiar experiences listening to someone read your book. Occasionally you hear a sentence and you think, gosh, I wish I'd written that differently. But of course, by then there's nothing you can do.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed listening to The Explorer and to Rooftoppers. They reminded me of the adventure stories that I stayed up reading all night when I was a lad. Was there a book that you read at that age that made you want to become a writer?
I'm not sure if there was one book that made me want to become a writer, because I think I wanted to be a writer before I could read. When people read books to me, I knew that that was what I wanted. I wanted to live amongst stories. But there was a book by Diana Wynne Jones called Charmed Life, which was written in the 80s, and it's a bit like Harry Potter, but funnier and sharper, more acerbic. And the world is stranger. And I remember being so in love with that book. I read it probably about 100 times by the time I was an adult. I think that she is a great writer for children.
Mr. Nostrum's charges for teaching magic turned out to be £1 an hour for the elementary grades and a guinea an hour for the advanced grades beyond. Rather expensive, as Mrs. Sharp said. She put on her best hat with black beads and ran round to the town hall to see if the fund would pay for Gwendolyn's lessons. To her annoyance, the mayor refused. He told Mrs. Sharp that witchcraft was not part of an ordinary education. Mrs. Sharp came back rattling the beads on her hat with irritation and carrying a flat cardboard box the mayor had given her, full of odds and ends the kind ladies had cleared out of Gwendolyn's parents' bedroom. "Blind prejudice!" Mrs. Sharp said, dumping the box on the kitchen table. "If a person has a gift, they have a right to have it developed, and so I told him. But don't worry, dearie," she said, seeing that Gwendolyn was looking decidedly stormy. "There's a way round everything."
Charmed Life by Diana Wynne Jones is TB12325. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, well, there's a book that I know so well I don't really need to reread it, but I still carry it everywhere with me, which is Jane Austen's Emma. If I'm ever going on a long journey, I'll take it with me, because I find such comfort in her wit and in her charm and in her irony and in the world that she conjures, the look of it, the feel of it that you can just imagine. So she has always been very, very precious to me, Emma Woodhouse and Jane Austen, both of them.
Mr. Woodhouse was fond of society in his own way. He liked very much to have his friends come and see him. And from various united causes, from his long residence at Hartfield and his good nature, from his fortune, his house and his daughter, he could command the visits of his own little circle in a great measure as he liked. He had not much intercourse with any families beyond that circle. His horror of late hours and large dinner parties made him unfit for any acquaintance but such as would visit him on his own terms. Fortunately for him, Highbury, including Randalls in the same parish, and Donwell Abbey in the parish adjoining, the seat of Mr. Knightley, comprehended many such. Not unfrequently, through Emma's persuasion, he had some of the chosen and the best to dine with him. But evening parties were what he preferred. And unless he fancied himself at any time unequal to company, there was scarcely an evening in the week in which Emma could not make up a card table for him.
There are several recordings of Emma by Jane Austen available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you would like to share with the listeners?
I think the book I've loved most recently is probably one that everyone in the world has also loved recently, which is Philip Pullman's The Book of Dust, Volume 1, La Belle Sauvage, which I think is just a masterpiece, inevitably. He is a great hero of mine. And I think that this book really does, the first sentence pulls you back into that world that we all adored with the Northern Lights trilogy.
3 miles up the River Thames from the centre of Oxford, some distance from where the great colleges of Jordan, Gabriel, Balliol, and 24 others contended for mastery in the boat races, out where the city was only a collection of towers and spires in the distance over the misty levels of Port Meadow, there stood the Priory of Godstow, where the gentle nuns went about their holy business. And on the opposite bank from the priory, there was an inn called The Trout. The inn was an old stone-built, rambling, comfortable sort of place. There was a terrace above the river, where peacocks, one called Norman and the other called Barry, stalked among the drinkers, helping themselves to snacks without the slightest hesitation, and occasionally lifting their heads to utter ferocious and meaningless screams. There was a saloon bar, where the gentry, if college scholars count as gentry, took their ale and smoked their pipes. There was a public bar, where watermen and farm labourers sat by the fire or played darts, or stood at the bar gossiping or arguing, or simply getting quietly drunk. There was a kitchen, where the landlord's wife cooked a great joint every day, with a complicated arrangement of wheels and chains turning a spit over an open fire. And there was a potboy called Malcolm Polstead. Malcolm was the landlord's son, an only child. He was 11 years old, with an inquisitive, kindly disposition, a stocky build, and ginger hair. He went to Ulvercott Elementary School, a mile away, and he had friends enough, but he was happiest on his own, playing with his demon, Aster, in their canoe, which was called La Belle Sauvage.
Michael Sheen narrating La Belle Sauvage by Philip Pullman, which will be available from the RNIB library soon. Catherine Rundle, thank you for sharing the books of your life and for being a guest on Read On. Rooftoppers is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, where you'll also find The Explorer as TB 702516. Braille and giant print copies will be joining it there soon. For more information, visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. And don't forget, if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Alas, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our previous shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.